This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Juno Diaz, who teaches writing at MIT, has a new reason for his students to pay close attention. Last month, he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his best-selling novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Diaz describes Oscar, the main character in his novel, as, quote, a ghetto nerd at the end of the world, unquote. Oscar is a Dominican-American kid who doesn't fit into the macho culture that surrounds him. He's overweight and is a hardcore science fiction and fantasy fan who fears he will remain a virgin for the rest of his life. The novel follows several generations of a Dominican family living under dictatorship on the island and emigrating to the U.S. Juno Diaz emigrated with his family from the Dominican Republic to New Jersey when he was 6. Terry spoke with him last year when the novel was published.
Juno Diaz, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your novel. I'm going to ask you to introduce it for us.
Oh, okay. Thank you. This is the a character named Junior, who's this big, muscle-building knucklehead, describing his college roommate, Oscar, who's this really big nerd who's trying to, you know, find someone to fall in love with. And so this is him talking about poor Oscar and his girl troubles.
Wait, I'm going to stop you for 1 second. I think I should mention that there's going to be references in this reading to names that people won't necessarily know. And every time you hear a name you don't necessarily know, can we assume it's from a science fiction book or a video game?
Yeah, or something from the Dominican Republic. Sometimes you can't tell.
Right, okay. Why don't you do the reading?
Thank you. Did I try to help him with his girl situation, share some of my playerly wisdom? Of course I did. Problem was, when it came to the mujeres, my roommate was like no one on the planet. Dude weighed 307 pounds, for Christ's sake. Talked like a Star Trek computer. The real irony is that you never met a kid who wanted a girl so bad. I mean, I thought I was into females, but no one, and I mean no one, was into them the way Oscar was. To him, they were the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, the DC and the Marvel. Holmes had it bad. Couldn't so much as see a cute girl without breaking into shakes. Developed crushes out of nothing. Must have had at least 24 high-level ones that first semester alone. Not that any of these ever came to anything. How could they? Oscar's idea of G was to talk about role-playing games. How crazy is that? My favorite was the day on the e-bus when he informed some hot morena, if you were in my game, I would give you an 18 charisma. I tried to give him advice, I really did. Nothing too complicated, like stop hollering at strange girls on the streets and don't bring up the beyonder any more than necessary. But did he listen? Of course not. Trying to talk sense to Oscar about girls was like trying to throw rocks at Eunice the Untouchable. Dude was impenetrable. He'd hear me out and then shrug. But my favorite conversation that semester? Junior? What? Are you awake? Oscar, if this is about Star Trek... It's not about Star Trek. He coughed. I have heard from a reliable source that no Dominican male has ever died a virgin. You, who have experience in these matters, do you think this is true? I sat up. Dude was peering at me in the dark, dead serious. Oscar, it's against the laws of nature for a Dominican man to die without having sex at least once. That, he sighed, is what worries me.
That's Juno Diaz reading from his new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. That was a great reading. Thank you for doing that. Oscar is really like the opposite of the stereotype of the macho Dominican man. Do you relate to him? Do you have that level of nerdiness within you?
You know, it's funny because one of the things about being an adolescent, which I kind of drew upon a lot when writing this book, is that you always feel like you're the biggest freak in the world. And so I was nerdy, certainly, up to a certain age, never as crazy as Oscar. But what mattered most was the entire time I was growing up, I always felt like, man, there's never been anyone like me, and there'll never be anyone like me again, and that's probably a good thing.
This isn't the kind of question I usually ask people I've just met, but were you as worried as Oscar that you'd never lose your virginity?
No, I think my problem was I was terrified that I was going to get someone pregnant like the rest of my neighborhood. I mean, it seems like everybody I knew, my sister got pregnant when she was a teenager. A lot of my friends had kids. And so my big terror was that, like, I would get somebody pregnant in high school. That would be the end of all things.
Did you?
No. I'm telling you, the terror shaped my behavior.
So you took precautions.
Yeah, that's a mild way of putting it. Yeah.
What was the kind of man you thought you were supposed to be? What kind of young man did you think you were supposed to be?
Well, I mean, part of what interested me about Oscar was that, like, this character of this kind of Dominican nerd living in New Jersey, he was the far extreme. You know, we have characters like him in all our communities, and it's more crazy when your community's kind of poor, kind of immigrant. People like him really stick out, but he's still there. And when I grew up with a military dad, was in the military in the Dominican Republic, seriously into that kind of discipline. I mean, the old man used to check our shoelaces before we left the house to see that they were, like, tied correctly. And he was really into boxing and really into fighting. And he was the kind of dude who really believed that if boys didn't fight all the time, that, you know, someone was going to take advantage of them or something was going to happen to them. So he always had me and my brothers and the neighboring kids fight all the time. It was like Fight Club without, you know, the cute boys. You were just, like, smacking each other around. Yeah. And so I would go to school, you know, I would go to school. This was in the day when, you know, there was no, people didn't care. You could show up to school with two black eyes and a busted lip, and your teachers would be just like, please turn to page 3. So the kind of boy I was, or that I was told to be, you were kind of this, like, half gladiator, half dude who, you know, was supposed to have as many girls as possible and work until your heart exploded, have no fear, you know. And it was such a weird thing because you're a little kid, of course, and I'm doing all this stuff. And the whole time you're thinking, why don't I feel like this is normal?
What about the part of you that liked to read books and was interested in writing?
Well, I mean, that also came out in some ways. And the one thing my old man is, he always had a shelf of books in the basement. And there were always books about history, about the Dominican Republic, about politics. And I think, you know, in some ways he modeled some bizarre masculine behavior, but he also modeled that reading could be masculine. And that saved me, like, a lot of bizarre contradictions, because I just really got into reading from a young age. You know, I was a kid who had difficulty speaking English when I first immigrated, but in my head, when I read a book, I spoke English perfectly. And I think that I retreated to books as a way, you know, to be, like, masterful in a language that was really difficult for me for many years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Junot Diaz, and his novel is called The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. In your novel, you write a lot about Trujillo, who was the dictator in the Dominican Republic from about, 1930 till his assassination in 1961. And the mother in the book, Oscar's mother, grew up in the Dominican Republic. And she was a beautiful woman when she was young. And you write in the book how it was understood if Trujillo saw a beautiful woman, he would have her as his own. And so fathers would lock up their daughters to prevent that from happening, unless they wanted it to happen, which her father did not.
Yeah, that was more disturbing. Yeah, like, lots of fathers in that historical period happily gave up their daughters to curry favor from the dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear stories about this? Was this research or stories handed down by family?
It was a lot of both. I mean, one of the things about, like, what does the Dominican Republic matter to the United States? And more specifically, what does what happened to somebody in Santo Domingo matter to a kid who was born and raised in the U.S.? I mean, in some ways, those are the kind of questions that the narrative is trying to, like, wrestle with. And for me, that was the question. Even when I was growing up, I was left Santo Domingo young, grew up in the U.S. I was far more worried about if I knew all the Michael Jackson lyrics than listening to my folks' stories about what happened in Santo Domingo. And yet the shadow of the past has a way of, like, casting its power over our present, even when we deny it. And I think that what ended up happening to me was I became not aware of that there was all these stories about Trujillo and all these stories about the dictatorship, but that there was an absolute silence about the dictatorship, that no one was actually speaking in any clear way about those 31 years. And, you know, it's sort of like you look at a history book and find 40 pages missing right in the middle. I felt like when I grew up, I was like, this is strange. Both my parents and all their brothers and sisters grew up in this fearsome dictatorship, and yet none of them have spoken about it.
When you started asking them about it, which I assume you eventually did, what kind of stories did they tell you?
Well, you know, you go through a whole number of levels of evasions, you know, where they're just like, that's old stuff. Oh, nothing happened. I had nothing to do with this, you know. But eventually, if you keep going and you're persistent, you begin to get the outlines of what happens when a country is isolated from the rest of the world and is controlled by a single madman. And it was like a nightmare. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about a story, a very common story that I heard from family members about, you know, like so much of the island was informants that worked for the secret police, and how one man was walking down the street eating an orange and he threw the peel on the ground. At this time, the Dominican Republic was one of the cleanest countries in the world. And the secret police arrested the guy who threw the orange peel on the ground and the three nearest people to him because they should have apprehended him. And all of them were whisked off to jail.
Was anyone in your family ever, you know, beaten by Trujillo's men or put in jail?
Oh, man, that's the kind of question that would have probably stopped the entire questioning if I pushed too hard. It always felt like there were people in my family who were involved in every piece of that history, but in weirder ways. My father was actually in the military police of the dictatorship and the post-dictatorship. And that was another bizarre thing where instead of being in some ways having a family member who was a victim of it, my father was part of that kind of structure and brought the regime home in ways that I think were, if we say in Spanish, impresionante, that were really, it was really powerful. I mean, that regime of the Trujillato, we lived in our house. I mean, we always joke around that in my family we had the dictatorship of our home.
What are some of the ways that he brought it home?
Well, I mean, I just think about lining up all your kids and examining their shoelaces is a perfect example of the Trujillato. I mean, in this period, this is like people would get assassinated. But first, before they were assassinated, Trujillo and his minions would critique their clothing and their dress styles in the newspaper, and the next day he would kill them. And so there was his huge sartorial obsessions. And then again, my father's constant belief that at any moment something catastrophic would come. I mean, it was a country that was always kept on edge, you know?
Was it upsetting for you to find out that your father was in the military of the bad guys?
Well, I mean, the best way to answer that is almost the entire island was complicit in the dictatorship. Some of us were more complicit than others. And so, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, my father was in the military, but, you know, you walked around my neighborhood and people always say, you know, the thing about your father was that your father, like, never pulled his gun, never hurt anybody, which, you know, you couldn't say about everyone else there. And at the same time, I had a mother who was wounded during the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965. So you have people in the family who fit in different places in this kind of historical moment. So, you know, you had a father who was in some ways this pro-dictator kind of guy. You had a mother who was wounded by the U.S. invasion. And as a kid, what do you do with all that history?
How was she wounded?
Oh, well, you know, the main city was bombed, Santo Domingo was bombed repeatedly by American and pro-American forces, so caught up in one of those bombings.
How badly hurt was she?
You know, just wounded, you know, hospital for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. When did your parents decide to move to the U.S., to New Jersey more precisely?
When everybody realized that the country was going to enter a very dark period after the U.S. invasion, when it was called the 12 years, everybody began to leave because there were sort of death squads and all sorts of fun stuff. And, you know, my parents, my father, even though he was part of the regime, the military regime, he was like, there's no future here. This country is just going to eat itself. So, you know, he jumped out as soon as he could.
One of the things I love about your writing is that you combine so many different, you know, like styles of speaking in it. There's, you know, Dominican and like teen African-American slang, science fiction, you know, and just like, you know, fine, elegant writing. But it's also colloquial, you know, borrowed from different different cultures. And I guess I'm wondering, did you grow up feeling fluent in all those different cultures?
Yeah, you know what it is I think that most of us, I know I was exposed to dozens of idioms, dozens of vernaculars, and I think that we just choose to deploy some at any given time. So, you know, at home, out in my neighborhood, we grew up with a very black Puerto Rican English. Then we had to go to an overwhelmingly, you know, mainstream school. In my house, we spoke a very formal Dominican Spanish, but when we were hanging out with other people who spoke Spanish, it was really colloquial. Then we had all the pop culture stuff that knitted us together as a generation. Then we had the language that we just used among our little group. And what I thought was interesting for me when I was writing this book is that, you know, it's so hard in some ways to pull a self together when you have all these disparate threads running through your lives, when you have all these experiences, when you're always asked to choose one or two voices and that's it, because too many would be too many, you know? And in this book, it's like the one place I felt that all the voices that I had run into my head could have at home and could like speak at once and speak together.
And I have to say, as a reader, like, there's certain words in it I don't get. Like, I don't know who the Beyonder is. I assume that's a science fiction reference, but, you know.
Yeah,
I,
Marvel Comics.
Yeah, okay, but I didn't know that. But I figured that's fine, because I get it anyways. I know it's a it's from his kind of like comic book or science fiction world. And there was a few, like, you know, Spanish Dominican words that I didn't get, but I kind of got it, and it worked for me.
Well, you know, part of the thing that really interested me about the reading experience is that a lot of times we forget that a large portion of what we're reading we don't understand. And most of the time we just skip over it because it's sort of implicit. We don't understand a word, we'll just skip over it and keep going. But, you know, that's like a basic part of communication, you know, unintelligibility. And so if you're an immigrant, you're so used to not being able to understand large chunks of any conversation, large chunks of the linguistic or cultural codes. And part of what I was trying to get at when I was writing this book is that, you know, I wanted everybody at one moment to feel kind of like an immigrant in this book, that there would be one language chain that you might not get and that it was okay. Like, it might provoke in you like a reaction to want to know, and that's good because it'll make you go look and read other books and start conversations. But that life and the experience that most of us have in the world is that we tend to live in a world where a good portion of what we hear, see, and experience is unintelligible to us. And that, to me, feels more real than if everything was transparent for every reader.
There's a lot of bad luck in this book. And the narrator thinks that Oscar and his family have been living under a curse. And the curse is known as the F-U-K-U curse. Now, I wasn't sure whether this is supposed to be a reference to the English expletive that is awfully close to F-U-K-U.
No, not at all.
Or whether it's actually, like a Spanish word or... Like,
no, it's a real word in Santo Domingo. It's like one of these Nigerian words that we got thanks to 400 or 500 years of slavery.
Uh-huh.
It's called fuku, and it means like kind of bad luck, like afflicted bad luck. It's a real word.
Did you expect that other people like me might be confused by that? I'm not sure whether, like, if it was a reference at all to an F-U kind of curse.
You know, it's funny because it's only after the book was published and some people, I realized that in my mind, that word has been in my mind long before I spoke English.
Uh-huh.
So that has priority over the sort of the analog it has in English, you know? And so
Sure. It's
weird. I never thought of it till, and I'm not kidding, in an explicit way till the book was published.
I think that most Americans know less about Dominican history and Dominicans than they do, say, about Puerto Rican history or Mexican history or, you know, do you know what I mean? So I'm wondering, there were so many stereotypes that Mexicans and Puerto Ricans have to put up with. Do people even know enough about Dominicans to have stereotypes of Dominicans? Were there stereotypes of Dominicans when you were growing up?
Well, no. I mean, I think the first thing is that it assumes that bigotry, you know, differentiates too much. I mean, the funniest thing about being a Latino is that no one actually gets your national origin correct. Being a Latino guaranteed that I was going to be Mexican, Cuban, Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. Whoever you hated, I was at that time.
How
and
convenient.
The fact that, yeah. And the fact that my family's of African descent, I mean, I'm what they would call mulatto back on the island, but I have siblings who were phenotypically black. And so if you hated black people, we fit into that little category too. You know, that's what happens when you come from a place like Santo Domingo.
After you came to the United States when you were six, was it hard to learn English?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, part of, I think, what comes with the energy of this writing, or at least with the energy that I was trying to bring to the story, was that kind of realization that, you know, the languages that I acquired, you know, it was kind of an interesting process and an interesting struggle. One of the things that happens is I know that the very learning of English for me as a young person, the sort of difficulties I had, also gave me this enormous appreciation, you know, this enormous sense that, you know, language for many people, it's a commonplace, but for other people, it's a hard fought, a hard fought gain. And for me, it was like a real happy triumph to be able to learn a second set of languages. And that was like the wildest little joy when I finally heard myself speaking in English and I sounded like everybody else around me. As a kid, it's hard to underestimate what that feels like.
Was there a period when you were in school when you didn't understand what the teacher was saying because your English wasn't good enough yet?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, one of the things about learning a new language is just extended childhood. You know, when you're a kid and you don't know what the hell the adults are saying. When you're really young, most people don't have that memory. But what happens when you don't know a language that the rest of the world is talking? You either have to have an enormous imagination, and you have to have tremendous patience, because it's a process to learn a language, and you have to have a lot of strength. I think that people underestimate how much strength it takes kids to pick up a new language in a world where no one understands them. And you see, most people just say, these kids, they'll pick it up real quick. Oh, you were just 6 or 7. It must have been easy. I still see kids all the time, and I think we don't give them enough credit. You know, it takes a lot of courage for these young people to pick up a new language.
You know, as we were describing earlier, there's a curse that may or may not be responsible for all of the bad luck in the book's main family. And I was wondering if you grew up believing in curses or superstitions at all?
Oh, no. I was a real empirical kid. You know, it's like I had a real tough brother and a real tough sister, and they didn't believe anything that couldn't bite them. But what was great was that, you know, I'm living in a family with, you know, had this military dad. Everything was real precision. Everything was your word. You know, everything was exact on time. And, you know, I had a grandmother who would turn around and tell me the wildest stories about, you know, these folkloric stories, belief in curses, belief in monsters, the belief in dreams and ancestors. And I felt like, you know, you have these twin traditions running through your head in one household. And even if I didn't believe the stories about my ancestors or about, you know, curses, I was ceaselessly delighted. I loved those things.
So, I mean, obviously, your grandmother must have influenced your interest in storytelling. But what about your father's military discipline side? Do you think that there was part of that was helpful to you as a writer as well?
Well, you know, I think one of the weird things about being an immigrant is that you come to the country to work. You didn't leave the country behind so you could just lamp and, you know, watch TV. And one of the things that happened with all my siblings is that all of us, like, worked like dogs. I mean, from as soon as we could carry something, from as soon as we could lie to someone about our age, we all had jobs. And I think, you know, my dad's discipline certainly was helpful, but the conditioning of being an immigrant, of knowing that your mom is out there cleaning toilets for a living, a full day, and then coming home and still holding a family together. You know, you have that kind of survival guilt. You're like, your parents did everything for you, and the least you can do is work and try to support that effort. And more than anything, I think, if I think the what I do well as a writer, part of it is underpinned by that immigrant desire to work really hard, to kind of honor your parents' sacrifices for coming out to this strange country and in many ways giving up their entire lives. You know, and it's that honoring that really drove me.
Was there a part of your life when you were rebelling and not honoring and thought of them as being old-fashioned or from the old country, from not kind of getting what America was about, from not knowing either the slang or the music or the references?
We always thought our parents were dumbasses, but, you know, just like immigrants, that didn't mean we stopped working. It was crazy. We could have bad-mouthed our parents and been like, these guys, they don't know nothing. And yet, boy, oh boy, we'd all still go to our jobs every damn day, deliver our 200 newspapers before dawn, you know, go to our second jobs at night. And so, yeah, no, it was interesting because, you know, you could think one way about them, but our praxis was real, real in line with them.
What were some of the jobs that you held?
Oof, man. My favorite series of jobs was the one year when I was a dishwasher in a Chinese restaurant for dinner. I pumped gas early in the morning, and during the day I worked in a steel mill. And I did these three jobs for a while till I just collapsed from exhaustion. So it was like, you know, this is the kind of stuff you do. But I delivered pool tables for over 10 years. That was wild. That was a great experience because it just gave you access to a whole world, to a whole range of people, you know?
Wow. Were you writing during all of these jobs?
Well, no. I mean, I was reading. More than anything, I think that's what's... When I think about the book and I think about this novel specifically, I'm so interested in sort of the reactions that I'm getting from folks that I just meet at bookstores or folks that I meet in the street, or just people that come up to me and talk to me. You know, if it happens once a month, you're kind of excited, you know. And one of the things for me is that this is a book that's about a love of reading, and it's a book that speaks to people who love reading. And more than being a writer, I feel like I've always been a reader. For me, I write because I love to read so much. What's so fascinating is readers think of books quite differently than, say, critics or, say, academics. I mean, if you look at most readers' bookshelves, they have an incredible diversity of books, of texts, of voices, and they live comfortably with it, you know? And that's part of what I was trying to do in this book, is see if I could get all these different highs and lows and middles. And could they fit together in a book the way that all those different books in my youth fit together in a bookshelf? And I wasn't sitting here dividing, these are the great 100 books and these are the junk. That's not the way I read.
So is it thrilling for you to not only be a writer, a published writer, but to be getting like such great reviews, having read all your life and thought about language so much? I mean, did you expect that you'd actually be able to pull it off?
I think, you know, my sense is always what's the next project. I mean, I think most of us, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I grew up in a different world, but most of the people I grew up with, we could never believe that we could do what we ended up doing. You know, it's like immigrants. I mean, if my mother could never have imagined how she would start on a farm in Santo Domingo and end up in a house right across the George Washington Bridge in New Jersey with these children who are all like professionals in some ways, you know. And I know I never thought that, to be completely honest, I never thought that I would have the career I have now. I mean, it's such a huge blessing. But there's a part of me in the end that knows that any kind of accolades and any kind of praise that's just provisional. If you're serious about this tradition, if you're serious about participating in writing and in reading, you know that what you're really about is that you're trying to build a relationship with a reader that you'll never meet and that you'll never see. And you want that relationship. You want a book to last on a shelf longer than the fireworks of people saying, oh, you done well, son. You did well. I mean, really great art has to last. And you never know if you've done really great art, because there's plenty of people who were praised in their days that we don't read anymore at all.
I'm assuming the answer to this will probably be yes, but I'll ask it anyways. Did your parents' English get good enough so that they could actually read your books?
Oh, no, not at all. My mother only speaks Spanish. She doesn't read English at all. She thinks what I do is, she finds my work to be, she's like, man, this is crazy. You are our smart one. We wanted you to be a doctor. So,
is it frustrating that they can't share in your books? They can't, you know, your mother can't read them.
Well, no, I mean, she'll read them when they get translated into Spanish. But, I mean, I think that it's, so many of us do stuff that's, our professions are so incredibly specialized. I mean, I teach at MIT. Mm-hmm. My students, the average human being couldn't even begin to talk to my students about what their professional interests are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got kids who do a high-energy physics. You ever try to talk to a high-energy physicist about what they're doing? I mean, I feel like, man, that's, I can't even begin to understand the second word that comes out of their mouth. My mom at least says, well, I got my son's book. I could put it on my shelf and show it to relatives, you know?
Right, absolutely.
So, I mean, sure, you know, I mean, everybody wants to be perfectly transparent and wants everybody to know, you know, your parents to know everything about you. But reality is, it's a new world of specialization, Terry. It's like, you're lucky if people can even remember your job title.
Juno Diaz, it's really been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much.
Juno Diaz, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. His best-selling novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, recently won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Chuck Berry is a figure who is central to the whole meaning of rock and roll. But what do we really know about what made him so important? With the release of Berry's entire recorded output from the 1950s, in a 4-disc set from Hip O Select, Ed Ward takes a close look at Berry's early career.
Say the words rock and roll, and the notes we just heard seem to play in a lot of heads automatically. They were played on January 6, 1958, by a 33-year-old black man who was a licensed cosmetician as well as a convicted car thief. He was 2.5 years into a career as one of the top popular musicians in the United States and had already written a body of songs which defined the teenage American experience. You Can't Touch Me, Roll Over Beethoven, Too Much Monkey Business, School Day, Rock and Roll Music, Sweet Little 16, and Reelin' and Rockin'. Despite his Asian experience, his songs resonated with people half his age and sold significantly better to white audiences. The closer you look at Chuck Berry, the odder he seems. He recorded for a Chicago blues label, Chess, to which he'd been brought by none other than Muddy Waters, hardly someone you'd go to if you were looking for the white teenage market. But one thing Muddy Waters understood was guitar playing. And as competitive as he was, he probably realized immediately that not only was this guy good, but he didn't represent a threat to Muddy's command of Chicago blues. Which isn't to say that Chuck wasn't a demon when it came to slide guitar playing. Feeling is, as far as I know, the only recording we have of Chuck Berry playing a Hawaiian steel guitar instead of his trademark Gibson ES-350T, and it's breathtaking. Nor is it particularly obscure. It was the B-side of School Day, Ring Ring Goes the Bell, so there were plenty of copies sold. Chess was apparently in awe of Berry's guitar playing, so much so that they recorded loads of instrumentals, possibly with the aim of using them as B-sides. Many of them remained unreleased for years. One thing that struck me about the early Chuck Berry recordings was how conservative they were. He recorded a lot of straight urban blues, as if he wanted a safety net if this whole teenage thing didn't work out.
I have changed, nothing like I used to be. changed, darling. Nothing like I used to be. When I cared so much for you, I was love blind and I couldn't see.
That could just as easily be Johnny Moore's Three Blazers from 1953, a sound still popular in black cocktail lounges when Berry recorded I've Changed in December 1955. But from the sound of things, the teenage thing was working out.
Right back to the language. Roll over, Beethoven.
In fact, and maybe it's just listening to this from today's perspective, the obsession with teenagers, teenage girls in particular, is a little unnerving coming from a guy in his 30s.
I got lumps in my throat when I saw her coming down the aisle. I got the wiggles in my knees when she looked at me and sweetly smiled. There she is again, standing over by the record machine. A minute over 17. Meanwhile, I was thinking, she's in the mood, no need to break it. I got a chance, I ought to take it. If she'll dance, we can make it. Come on, Queenie, let's shake it. Go, go!
But as we're constantly reminded, those were more innocent days, and it's likely that nearly everyone missed any hint of impropriety in lyrics like these. And it was the lyrics, literate, funny, tricky, and enunciated very clearly, that endeared Chuck Berry to a lot of his audience.
Oh, well, I feel so good today. We just touched ground on an international runway. Jet propelled back home from overseas.
This patriotic number with backup singers, including Etta James and a young Marvin Gaye, is still one of Berry's best lyrics, recorded early in 1959. He probably didn't see what was coming next. Later that year, he was arrested for violating the Mann Act, transporting a minor across state lines for immoral purposes. What exactly happened has never been cleared up, although the charge was almost certainly exaggerated. He was eventually found guilty, and the man who had helped define American teenage culture, rewritten the rules of the electric guitar, and written songs which are still played today almost as he wrote them, was sentenced to 20 months prison in early 1962.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Chuck Berry, Johnny B. Goode, his complete 50s chess recordings, is on Hippo Select. The much-anticipated movie based on the Marvel comic superhero Iron Man opens today. Robert Downey Jr. stars, along with Gwyneth Paltrow, Terrence Howard, and Jeff Bridges. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Watching Iron Man, it occurred to me that every age gets not the superhero it deserves, but the superhero who will ease its anxieties, picking up on bad vibes and transforming them into something that lets us sleep better. In the 30s, Superman was a Midwest farm boy who came to Metropolis with the power to clean up crime and continually rescue a nervy woman reporter. This in the first decade of mass heartland-to-city migration and headstrong female role models. After the surge of urban crime in the 70s, Batman went from a camp figure to a brutal urban vigilante. Now, the Marvel comic Iron Man is reborn on screen as a rousing liberal fantasy in which America redeems itself for its alleged history of war profiteering. The hero, Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr., is a billionaire playboy, an inventor, and an arms manufacturer. Here, he's confronted by Leslie Bibb as a Vanity Fair reporter.
Mr. Stark, Christine Everhart, Vanity Fair magazine. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
She's cute. She's all right.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's okay?
Okay, go.
You've been called the Da Vinci of our time. What do you say to that?
Absolutely ridiculous. I don't paint.
And what do you say to your other nickname, the Merchant of Death?
That's not bad. Let me guess. Berkeley?
Brown, actually.
Well, Ms. Brown, it's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beams for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
I can see that.
I'd like to show you firsthand.
The next shot is Stark in the sack with her. But things don't go smoothly after that. Stark jets to Afghanistan to demonstrate an ingenious guided missile. Then his convoy is blown up by an IED. You'd think you were watching an up-to-the-minute Mideast military thriller, and a depressing one. Kidnapped, Stark wakes up in a cave, where a kindly Afghan civilian, played by Sean Tobe, has implanted a magnet in his chest to keep shrapnel from drifting to his heart. The insurgents who took him command Stark to make a missile like the one he just sold to the Americans. But crafty Stark takes their materials and builds a different sort of weapon. The Iron Man superhero he becomes has little in the way of expression, but his eye slots and the circular magnet in his chest have an unearthly glow, and his coloring is warm, gold trimmed with red, like a sunset. The director, Jon Favreau, often cuts to Downey's head inside the helmet, somewhat buffering the fact that the Iron Man is computer-generated. His first liftoff and crash owe a lot to Brad Bird's The Iron Giant, although Favreau would probably say it's an homage. After he escapes, Stark is reborn in another way. Out of his suit, he shocks the press and his number two, Obadiah Stane, played by Jeff Bridges, with a little beard and bald dome, making his bid for William Hurt's hold on the ex-leading man hambone character actor market.
Tony, we're a weapons manufacturer.
I'll be Tony. I don't want a body count to be
that's,
our only
that's
legacy.
What that's what we do. We're ironmongers. We make weapons.
It's my name on the side of the building.
And what we do keeps the world from falling into chaos.
Not based on what I saw. If we're not doing a good enough job, we can do better. We're going to do something else.
Like what? You want us to make baby bottles?
It isn't long before Iron Man jets back to rescue innocent Afghan men, women, and kids from marauding warlords, using his might and money and American ingenuity to undo his damage. This is a very shapely piece of myth-making, crisply made and well-cast. Downey demonstrates his character's do-gooder conversion by looking as if he's been yanked out of a hedonistic dream. His self-love dries up. But he's still a hoot as he tests out his powers, painfully, and amazes his friends and foes. His loyal assistant, Pepper Potts, isn't much of a part, but Gwyneth Paltrow looks flabbergastingly pretty and zings barbs with aplomb. I had a great time at Iron Man, but I wonder about the complacency it encourages, the idea that one extraordinary capitalist can undercut the military-industrial complex. I know it's a popcorn movie, but at a time when America is viewed around the world as arrogant, will the picture be seen as another in that long line of Hollywood superhero movies aimed at making Americans feel better about themselves? Will it be taken as proof we're living in a comic book or an impregnable golden shell?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.